This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It has been a fascinating couple of episodes getting introduced to 95-year-old Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California. First through his newfound friend, Les Beck, whose father was in Stalag 17B in the same barracks as Orville during World War II. Then from the sharp and colorful memories of Orville himself. Again, if you missed the first part, you can dial it up, that podcast, on hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off, Orville mentioned an 18-day forced march. The reason that you had to march out of that camp in Krems, Austria in April of 1945 was the Russians were approaching, and the Germans really didn't want to be there when the Russians arrived, right?
That's correct, because the Russians and the Germans sure didn't get along.
They said, okay, if you're a Russian prisoner, you go ahead and stay here, but we're taking everybody else and we're marching them. And you're one of those they marched?
Well, they marched the Russians too.
Yeah.
They took us all. We got to where we were going, they had them in a compound right next to ours.
So 18 days marching, what was the weather like? What was the food like? What were the conditions like? And was that scarier than staying in the camp?
Actually, I was happy to get out of that camp, and it was kind of scary, but now the weather was first night out, it came a sleet storm. We slept right out on the ground, and it rained a couple of times, but otherwise, I didn't mind the weather that bad at all. But one place, I forget the name of the town, it bombed out. The English are hitting at night and the American day, and that night, we slept in a bombed out where a bomb had hit all over, and they lit that place up. The English did at night, dropping bombs all around. And we crossed the bridge. It was loaded with explosives underneath. You could see them. The Austrians were slaughtering their beef because they didn't want the Russians getting it. And they gave us fresh meat. We got dysentery really bad. And walking through town, the guys, it's too bad. They had to go right in the streets. That's the worst part about that. But I took off and went home there. I had a piece of Ivory soap. And there's a bunch of women there, and I guess sewing circle or something, but I told them I wanted to trade that soap for something to eat. Prima Americana, Seifisch, Urein Brot. Well, they come out with a loaf of bread, and I give them about a quarter of a piece of Ivory soap. I run and got back in formation. And then we got to rest. They said, we're going to be here a couple of hours. Well, I took off. I went down a ravine. I walked down about a mile and I found a flour mill. I had a pair of GI pants. I traded that to him for about 5 pounds of flour, and I sneaked back into camp. There's a bunch of little young German boys. If they'd have found me, they'd kill you. They didn't ask any questions. They were mean little guys. But I got in and out and in, rather. Took 10, rolled it out, and made hardtack, just water with that. And I shared it with my buddies. That was rough walking because they made us walk pretty fast. But sometimes the farmers, they have milk cans out on the route, I guess, and they'd disappear as we'd walk by, guys sticking them up. And one place we went by the hen house, and the chickens were flying around in there, and the GIs run in there, and they come out with one under each arm. Here come the guard right behind them with a that goose net. But we picked up food like that, but my 25th birthday, we got Red Cross parcels. They went to a camp somewhere on the east side of Austria, and they'd been liberated. So they brought them back through, and they gave them to us. I got 15 pounds of concentrated food. Man, I'm telling you, that was relief. That's where we got our food then.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, it was the best birthday I ever had.
Tell me about how you finally realized, how it happened that you were finally a free man again. After almost 2 years of not knowing freedom, not tasting freedom.
Oh, it felt really good, but I'll tell you a little story on that. That was at La Havre, they built an airstrip. The first plane that landed there was a B-17. Well, I was in a tent with about 12 or 13 other guys. I went over there and I asked a pilot about a ride across the channel with him. He said, well, I'm not authorized to haul anyone, but said, I'm leaving, and he looked at his watch in about 10 minutes. I'm not looking back in the fuselage. Somebody happened to be back there. I'm not looking back there. So I run back to the tent and I grabbed all the guys in there. We run back and jumped in that fuselage. Just as we slammed the door, he took off down the runway. And we landed not at the same base that I was based at, Thetford. the guys lined up for payday. I walked in there, they treated me like a king. I'm telling you, I enjoyed that. Then I realized I was free. But I went in and stayed all night. I got polluted. And Lion Chief and I were good buddies. And I stayed out in his cabin out on the line. The head cook of the place, I knew him real well because he was always coming in late and he was feeding us when here in the States. He gave him steaks and things for us to cook out in the Lion Shack. He said he got them done. I laid down on one of the bunks. He couldn't wake me up. He said he poured water on me and everything. And I wouldn't wake up. But here come two young guys the next morning. They were playing. We're going to go on a mission over Berlin, and we're going to pick up some wax. Said, you want to go with us? I said, yeah, I'll go with you. And the line chief said, well, we got to go check a plane out. And we went out with him. He said, you want to run it up and check it out? And I said, sure. That was my job as flight engineer anyway. I went through all the checks. One engine a little low on fuel pressure. I told him, that won't hurt anything. He said, no, it won't. Well, in the meantime, I said, no, heck, I've made those missions. I've got back. I'm not going. Well, they jumped in there, and they went over, and they picked up, instead of getting whacked, they picked up some Englishmen. And they're right outside of our campus. They got up there. They went down, nosedive, killed every one of them. So I come that close, not getting back to the States.
Wow. There's so many unbelievable twists to your story. It's hard to buy all of it, but I know it's all true because you lived it all. And when you got back to your base after being a prisoner, after being gone for 2 years, there probably weren't a lot of guys left there that had been there when you were last there, but did anyone recognize you?
Oh, yes, the line chief and the cook, and there was some of the, I'd say about a dozen guys, old-timers still there.
They must have been a little surprised to see you.
Oh, they were. They were really surprised. And the line chief and I went into London. He got a pass. I wired home for money, and he ran out of money. He had to go back to base. And I was running around with two or three other guys there, and one star general walked by, and we didn't salute him. He turned around and chewed us out, said, don't you boys salute in your army? Yes, sir, but we're out of uniform. I didn't have a uniform. Right. He couldn't say anything. I went in right then and turned myself in because they didn't know. I thought I was still back in over in France, but I was in England.
I want to backtrack a little bit. Because you told me about Le Havre and coming back, and that is pretty brazen because there are some guys that got in trouble for pulling stuff like that, like what you pulled in Le Havre. But before that, at the end of the march, can you tell me about the moment where you realized you were not a prisoner anymore and freedom has returned?
Yes, I was staying with some Austrians. Well, actually, before the town was took over, Patton's advanced troops were there. By the way, one of the guys was in that lived right down the street here that liberated the camp. They were getting ready to fire into that camp because of smoke coming out. We had a doctor who was an officer, American, and he went in with a German officer and told him what was out there, so they didn't do it. Well, I was in town. They'd piled a bunch of guns up there, still taking it over. I found one that would shoot an ammunition that would go in it, and I saw some chickens in the yard there, and I shot two old hens and a rooster. Well, I took them out to camp to cook, put them on. I took off, went back to town to get some bread. It was about a mile. I went to a bakery. Said, no, we're out of bread. We don't have any. I can smell it. I went in anyway and went downstairs and it was loaded with bread, fresh baked in there. Well, I got the bread and I took it out and I took it back to camp and my chickens were gone. My souvenirs I'd gathered up was gone from a German soldier. And so I went back downtown with two of my buddies, same two that I got in a lot of meanest with in camp. And we used staying in with an Austrian and his family. And we stayed there until this Austrian told us the camp was not there anymore. It was all this copal and Yashmir. So sure enough, we went out there and they had bicycles. There was horses there. There were wagons, all kinds of transportation, all piled up in a big wad there. We walked into camp and here came a truck. The last truck picked us up and took us to an airport. And we flew over to Nancy, France. There we got on a train to Le Havre. In Le Havre, I ran into my pilot, Pickard, and talked with him for a while, but he was the only one I ran into that I knew.
Just that alone, though, that had to be a pretty special moment, huh? You didn't know if he was alive or not, right?
That's right. And we found out that the officers are all right, and our whole crew is all right, and everybody made it through. So that was a big relief. And I tried to get in touch with calling North Platte, Nebraska, where that was his hometown, and I never was able to get in touch with him. And Soderbergh was from Salt Lake. I never got in touch with him, or and the other officer was from New York. And then our co-pilot was from Texas. He's the one that escaped and got out. He went back to England. He wanted to fly a fighter plane, so I guess he went to the Pacific. I never heard from him again.
There aren't a whole lot of us who have experienced what you experienced. I don't know if anyone's experienced everything you've experienced, but there aren't very many people who've had to live for a couple days, let alone a couple years, in the absence of freedom. What did that teach you? What kind of perspective did that give you about the freedom that we have in this country that you and 16 million Americans fought for in World War II?
Well, it made me feel good about it, about America, that's for sure. It makes me want to pull the head off some of those politicians we had. Well, there's nothing like being freedom when you don't appreciate it till you actually know what it's about. Just be able to tell somebody off in any words you want to use. We've got language we can use and get away with it. And those other countries, you don't dare do it. And I don't know, it's something most people just take for granted, but it's sure not there. There's a reason why we still talk English.
What do you remember about seeing your family again when you got home?
Well, they went to Fresno to pick me up because I'd called them on the telephone from up north. But coming home on the bus, another soldier and me got kicked off and put the civilians on it. And we walked that night to another bus stop somewhere up along the line there, Lodi or someplace. And we caught a bus into Fresno. And then I rode a bus on into Reedley, where my parents live. And they'd went to Fresno, and so I missed them. But I was at the house when they got back. And my sister-in-law was there. My brother's still over in the other theater. But she stayed there with my folks. And then my uncles and aunts lived next door, so I'd visit with all them before my folks could come in. They were kind of surprised I was at the house when they got. I went to the post office to find my address. I mean, how to find where my folks lived out on Duff Avenue. She said, "Oh, so you're the one been writing those letters." Said, "I've been wondering about you," and said, "I'll take you to their house." So the postmistress took me to their house.
And I imagine that the looks on your parents' faces were probably memorable.
Oh yes, that's right. First time I ever saw my dad cry. But he did. The joy, though.
How about you? Did you get a few tears out, or were you so desensitized to all this that wasn't part of your experience?
No, it shook me up even. My sister-in-law said, "Well, I saw a tear in your eyes." I said, "Yeah, maybe." I was glad to be home. I hadn't seen my parents in 3.5 years.
I'm sure your kids and grandkids are glad you made it home. You've been out in this part of the country ever since you came home from the war?
Yes, I have been. I came here and I bought a place here in Orange Cove, and I worked with the National Park Service and the Forest Service, retired out of the Forest Service, and I've been all around, but my home's always been here in Fresno County.
You've shared a lot, and I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for serving our country, for enduring what you did, and for telling us your story. When you think back on it, is there something you went through or something you realize now that means the most to you, that amazes you the most, that makes you feel the most proud of all these years later?
No, not any one thing. There's probably lots of things that made me proud to be an American. There's the way the guys all stuck together through the war there. They were comrades. We just did not fuss among ourselves that much. We'd argue sometimes. We had a radio man we all argued with, and I even picked him up one time, throw him against the wall, and go whip him. But then we'd go out and buddy together at night. But we were friends. It just he was in New York, and I was at Oakey, so we clashed.
This may be a hard one to answer, because I certainly don't mean to make light of or suggest that it's no big deal that you went through what you went through. Because I know you were starving. I know you were freezing. You talked about the pain in your feet and all of that. I'm sure you weren't treated well every day. It was a nightmarish experience. But when you think of the 70 years since you were liberated, are you thankful for what you went through? Did that change your perspective on the rest of your life?
Well, I wouldn't take anything for any amount of money for the experiences I've got behind me, but I wouldn't want to go through it again. That's for sure. I'll look at it like this. I'm not going to start a fight with any country. But if any country comes here and wants to fight with me, I got a lot of buddies.
What keeps you going at 95?
I don't know. Just one thing. Well, I got a lot of grandkids and things. I enjoy those kids. my dogs and just being alive.
Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to say?
No, not necessarily. No, there's things that I haven't even talked to my wife, even, who I lost about 18 months ago. We were married 68 years, 2 months and 8 days. But I never told her some of the things or anybody else. I never will. I blank them out of my mind, and that's it. Not that other guys haven't done worse, have went through worse things than I have. Just, I happen to be at the time of war when it was at worst. And I saw things that I wouldn't want to see again. And I know I'm not going to.
Well, let's all hope and pray no one ever does. And it's a fitting way to wrap up this conversation with the understanding that as much as we hear from the veterans who share their firsthand perspective on history with us, as much as our 21st century minds are amazed by some of the things they went through, there are often stories that are even then too difficult for them to even bring to the forefront. Orange Cove, California had a population of a little less than 10,000 at the last census. We have met one absolutely fascinating man who's been there about as long as anyone. Remember to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos, videos, and the whole story of his chance encounter with the son of his old barracks mate. And do a little homework. National POW MIA Recognition Day is coming up on the third Friday of September. That's when it's observed every year, a chance to honor and remember people like Orville Lewis. So wherever you're listening today, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a POW MIA event near you. See if you can be a part of it. And join us again for the next installment of Hometown Heroes when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.